Hello, everyone. I'm Ferris Taylor, Executive Director of the Healthcare Executive Group. Thank you for joining this podcast, part of our ongoing 2020 HCG Virtual Thought Leadership Series. The corona pandemic has changed the world dramatically. Since late February, healthcare organizations have been largely in crisis mode, adapting to new testing and treatment demands and strategies, all the while struggling to stay afloat emotionally, physically, financially, and other ways during these difficult times. They're dealing with supply chain challenges impacting personal protective equipment and pharmaceuticals. They're dealing with and adopting to telehealth and accelerating their existing use of virtual health services. They're dealing with financial uncertainties due to their focus on COVID-19. And or due to the destruction of demand for non-COVID related services. The harsh reality of a fee-for-service reimbursement system has negatively impacted many provider and health plan organizations. And there are many other challenges and changes caused by the pandemic and the response to the pandemic that are not yet fully or known or understood. On top of that, now our school systems are struggling to safely reopen and bring some semblance of normalcy back to work, family, and children. And as autumn rapidly approaches, addressing concerns about potential impacts from kids returning to school and the fall flu season coming up are topics of discussion among many executives. To help shed some light and insight from the perspective of a physician executive, the Healthcare Executive Group hosted an informal discussion with three physician executives, including our longtime HCG board member, Dr. David DiLoretto, a board-certified ophthalmologist and ophthalmic plastic surgeon, currently a principal at Vizient SG2, and prior a senior vice president at GE Healthcare. We also have Dr. Johanna Vidal-Phelan, a senior medical director in pediatrics at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center Health Plan, UPMC, and a practicing pediatrician at the Hamilton Health Center, a federally qualified health center in Harrisonburg, Pennsylvania. And finally, Dr. Jason Wu, a practicing board-certified obstetrician gynecologist and a veteran with 31 years in the Commissioned Corps of the U.S. Public Health Service. Dr. Wu is also a consultant with the Arbinger Institute. All three are considered premier HCG physician thought leaders. The goal of this discussion, captured today and in a planned series of blog posts on the HCG website, is to explore what physicians believe has changed and what has remained the same during the coronavirus pandemic. The intent of this recording and the blog series is to help set the theme and the content for a live, interactive physician chat and Q&A on October 1st at 2 p.m. Eastern, where these three physicians will provide additional insight on what's changed and what has remained the same under COVID-19, along with more on what can be expected this fall and going into 2021. To learn more and to submit questions and comments and requests for additional information, go to bit.ly/3physicians. So bit.ly/3physicians. So let's kick off this discussion among our three physicians on COVID-19, the challenges, the changes, and especially the issues leading into the fall season.
It's a pleasure to be with you. I do appreciate the opportunity to re-engage with HCEG. I think it's a great topic. We're hearing a lot about both from providers and payers and families and friends, what's next, right? And so it's perfect timing. I like the idea of recording this in blogs. There are technical issues that come up. And so from a production standpoint, I think you got exactly the right idea to do a recording. And I think the challenge, honestly, with this group is in 30 to 40 minutes is making sure that we, have some, the right topics. This group could go off in lots of different directions here. So I think if you got 5 or 6 questions, this is not, Jason and Johanna are not shy people. They're going to have a lot to say. And it's a matter of getting the dialogue in a way that the folks who are listening are going to get value out of. But there's a lot of uncertainty about what's going to happen. I'm taking my fourth of four children to college tomorrow and down south. I don't know how long he'll be. He'll be there. It's that kind of world right now. And I was on calls today with colleagues who are putting their younger children in school and having to be the principal and the teacher and prepare lunches and be the subject matter expert all in the same morning. So this is on everybody's mind. And so having healthcare subject matter experts who are in the trenches, not only thinking about it, but treating folks and really it's a great idea. So it's really coming up, and I like from the title, I like what Jason, I think, shared, which was getting ready for the fall. And you could have a subtitle to that, COVID-19 in the fall of 2020, so you could have a subtitle related to that if you wanted to.
Capture as you got the three of you talk some ideas that we can put into that catchy title. I think there's change that's taken place. David, you've been in healthcare much longer than I have, but the world has changed dramatically, but it's going to change some more. And what have we learned, and what's going to stick, and where's it going to go to? We can weave some of that in.
We certainly can. What changes and what stays the same? That's a lot of what we're trying to do. What's going to change and what's going to stay the same?
I liked it. I don't want to get too, marketing wise, but, preparing for the fall, what's changed and what's remained the same? And then how does leadership work with that? Anyhow. Mm-hmm. Right.
And David, you're with SG2, which is owned by
Vizient. And so Vizient is a member-owned improvement company. 2,000 U.S. health systems are members. It's got everything from the largest group purchasing organization. So we dealt a lot with supply chain issues this spring in the PPE and pharmaceutical shortages. We've got analytics companies that are now really redoing their algorithms to account for COVID impact factors. Mm-hmm. Particularly the group I'm with does a lot of market demand forecasting. And essentially what we're seeing is a lot of what we have been, virtual health, for instance, we've probably compressed the trend for adoption of virtual health by 5 to 7 years. Now people are figuring out, that was bootstrapping and video conferencing with families, but how do we really get the provider workflows adjusted so that this is meaningful and a productive way to deliver care? The other thing we're looking at, what's interesting, is how the impact factors are affecting utilization of services. So early on, we saw folks just avoiding the emergency room, even staying home with symptoms of stroke and myocardial infarction. The high acuity services have returned, but low acuity services have not, and we don't believe they ever will. These are things that basically probably shouldn't have been in the emergency room to start with, and folks are finding ways to deal with it. High acuity conditions, like TAVR procedures and neurosurgical procedures are actually coming back really strong. People almost at full, comparing the first 6 months of 2019, the first 6 months of 2020, basically the same utilization rates. What's interesting are more elective procedures, including things like PE tubes in children, which have only come back to about 40%. And so one of the issues there is could be a combination of factors, right? In the social distancing that was happening in the spring, maybe there was less URI infections. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, families that we know are avoiding, preventive services. There may be children with chronic ear infections and not getting detected now. There's things that, may play out long term that we have to figure out. There's a variable return of on the provider side of certain services. Essentially, on the provider side, people are having to do three things at once. They have to balance the treatment of COVID positive patients and non-COVID positive patients in the pandemic. And we watched those surges in places like Tampa and Los Angeles and Houston last month. And actually the provider community is getting a lot better at being able to balance that care. We know more about early intervention with certain treatments. There's less folks going on onto ventilators. And obviously we're protecting the most vulnerable people the elderly and institutions much better. On the other hand, the impacts financially, both from demand destruction as well as increased costs, are huge. We're seeing provider groups, hospitals, and health systems really having to deal now with not only the near-term financial recovery, but also some very significant economic issues. We're looking at unemployment rates in Florida right now, and in Orlando, where there's high rates of people employed in tourism and entry-level service jobs, unemployment rate about 20%. 100 miles up the road in Gainesville, where there's state government, big university, unemployment rate 8%. And 50 more miles over in Jacksonville, unemployment rate 6%. And so, we're going to see an economic issue towards the end of the year that's going to be very volatile. Some parts of the country, Hawaii, Las Vegas, tourism areas in Florida, very high unemployment rates, and other parts of the country, 4%, 5%, and 6%. So, we have to develop modeling tools around that. But I'll stop because it's really, Jason and Johanna have perspectives about the fall, right? And people, should I send my children to school? What should I look for? Am I at risk? How will they interact with aunts and uncles and grandparents? Is it really safe? And if they don't go to school, what does that mean? So there's those. I think that's the seminal issue for this discussion would be getting those thoughts. And obviously, Jason, with your background in public health, the impact really in disadvantaged communities has been huge, right? And it plays out in interesting ways, not just in urban centers, but was really interesting as we watched the surges in Los Angeles and Tampa and Houston, as they came down, the nearby rural areas, particularly where you had either migrant workers or low-income workers in fields, they were getting infected at very, very high rates. So you could spread out in the urban areas. And that's probably sort of the fits and starts with this that we're going to have throughout this pandemic until there's widespread use of vaccines, herd immunity, and more effective therapies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would.
Johanna, what are you advising your patients on when they ask you, is it safe to send someone to school?
So that's a very important question, and each family will have a different solution. And I think that the first thing I have to tell parents, and including myself as a parent, is to empower the parent to make the decision, and there's no wrong or right decision. You need to do what's right for your family. And so in partnership with the school district where your children are, and this is definitely, I'm going to think about different things that had happened in the last 10 years for families and children. This has been one of those aspects that had created a lot of anxiety for families, including myself. And I think it's a topic of very important discussion. Also in regards to the home environment, when children are actually, most of the kids in the state of Pennsylvania are not having the opportunity to return to school full time. So not 5 days. So they're doing a hybrid model or fully online. So what is the impact for a working family that has to figure out, come up with new solutions in regards to the care of the children during the days that they are not in school and the financial hardship that that may represent to a family? So I've seen families make very challenging decisions where one of the parents is no longer working, so that parent can help with the children in the home environment for schooling. And other families are sending their children, though they don't want to, or they don't feel comfortable because they have to go to work. I've seen a really dramatic impact in Latinos and minorities. As you know, Latinos families, minorities families are mainly in the service industry, many of us. And so what happens is that the level of exposure to COVID-19 is higher, disproportionately impacting African Americans and Latino. And so you think about families and the impact in children and what that means to them is significant. So it is a very challenging question. Parents ask me all the time in the pediatric practice, and I respond with the answer is it, what is it that is important to you as a family? What is it that you can provide or not for your children education? And then we have a frank discussion about what the family will need to do.
Yeah, I think coming from the public health perspective around particularly the FDA background, you know, there's just so much uncertainty in the testing and what information and understanding incidence prevalence and what the outcome of an infection is. You know, it's so critical to be non-judgmental of what, as you pointed out, Joanna, each family has to figure out what's best for them. And particularly in the, you know, as we're providing services, that's part of the challenge is to be aware of the individuality that has to be accounted for each of the patients or each of the patients coming or families coming into the healthcare system and trying to figure out what's right for them. I think the one thing I kick myself is I you know, at the beginning of all this, I was like so certain that, you know, that we would have such good data from the Diamond Princess, you know, that here was a cohort of 3,000 patients. They're going to, you know, they've got
isolated.
They're isolated. They're dropping in tests. The CDC's in there. They're doing sampling. And, you know, we're going to have so much information. And then after 2 weeks and nothing's coming out, I had completely missed that because, you know, we talk about the public health system being, you know, underfunded, but I never expected us to be so poorly informed in terms of the data of the natural course of an infection, of infectivity, of how quickly it spreads and how it spreads. And so now with the plethora of different testing and the different, you know, the way things are being approved or by the FDA, I think it's challenging because it's just not the kind of data that we or standards that we would have had, you know, when we did Ebola, when we did Zika. And I wouldn't say it's for lack of knowing how to deal with it. It's just the challenge of not having a sort of a standard upfront approach prepared to go upfront. And I don't want to say politics. I don't want to point fingers at all in this. It's simply, you know, that it was not the opportunity passed.
No previous experience. This is all new. I mean, you know, I wasn't around in 1918.
It is, well, but you know what? I remember H1N1. It was not like this. I mean, there is an element of trust. As a provider and also as a person working in the United States, you know, I should have not have to worry about where is my PPE coming from. I never crossed my mind in 2009 that I would not have enough PPE to protect myself against H1N1. And if you recall, pregnant women were at high risk for H1N1. And I was pregnant caring for pediatric patients with my second child. And I never had to think about it twice. And so now it's like the anxiety that providers have in the, you know, to know that they're having the correct equipment in order to provide the care, and also knowing so many of our peers are impacted by this disease and have died. It is, you know, it's something that you need to pause and think about, what are we doing?
Well, and there's something that happened, Jason, you've alluded to it, but Johanna, we talked months ago and you were reusing face masks. Now, I broke a tooth, and the deadening's worn off. I actually got the tooth ground off for a crown today, but the dentist can't get N95 masks, and you couldn't get N95 masks. This is, what, 5 months?
Yes. Yes, and now it's getting a little better, you know, and you're getting a little smarter and getting a little prepared, you know. But at the beginning, I mean, people were panicking
for the fall. Yes, it's going to continue.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I don't know if any of you saw it, I saw a physician's assessment, and David, you may be hearing, or you may have been the source of it, but 50% of the physicians are expecting that we won't be on top or ahead of COVID until June.
Mm. Our projections are that we'll be dealing with a pandemic situation probably into the fourth quarter of next year.
Fourth quarter.
Simply because even the production and distribution of effective vaccines, and of course the early trials are encouraging, but it's still a monumental undertaking. And also, we still don't know the issues about long-term effectiveness. There's still a lot of volatility around that. But let's talk about the fall, right? Because it's almost here. It seems like 2020 has been a decade, but we are finally in August. And so in addition to dealing with an ongoing pandemic, we'll have seasonal viruses and seasonal respiratory infections starting to come into play. Tell us a little bit about how you think it'll affect frontline practices, particularly with respect to testing strategies and recommendations for families. Jason?
Yeah. The question of is what do states do at this point in terms of making requirements for some of the school age kids to even participate, right? Then I think New York already came out with the mandatory testing. I think California also as well, because there's certainly been a lot of confusion. I mean, there are factors that we're not, as you point out, the variables. If kids aren't in school, how does that affect exposure rates that we're not going to project? But the uncertainty as a provider, right, I think that you're presented with for folks coming in is certainly be so dependent upon where our testing capabilities and how much better knowledge we have and how quickly folks can respond to that. And that's why it's very difficult. It gets back to the uncertainty of how quickly these conditions continue to evolve and to what extent we're able to get better information. There seems to be a lot of people working very hard at it, but there's just so much variation in the testing. And so I think it's going to be particularly hard for providers to make that, but there's just still a lot of uncertainty about what those actually prevalence rates are going to be with the different conditions, right? If kids aren't in school, how does that affect the general trend of seasonal viruses? And Johanna, you have thoughts?
Yes. I mean, so we saw a decline of seasonal viruses during the spring, and early beginning of the summer. I think right now you have to think about the monumental impact of children returning to school, even if it's 2 days. Our children have been with us since March 13, 4 p.m., when school released them and said they're not coming back. We don't know when. And so our children have been really, really exposed to a lot of other people. So we do know that children are going to be exposed not only to COVID-19, but, all the other normal viruses that we see or bacteria like strep throat. I think one of the important messages that I've been sharing with my family since day one is the importance of the flu vaccine. And there is a lot of misinformation and misunderstanding about the flu vaccine. People still believe that you get sick from the flu vaccine, that you are going to develop the flu from the flu vaccine. A lot of families, like almost not even 50% of the population in the United States gets the flu vaccine every year. And so if we want to have that good herd immunity, it is important. And I explain to the parents that providing the flu vaccine to your child and your family is a way to combat a coronavirus. And they look at me like, why? It's a different virus. And I said, because when your child gets sick with the flu, because you didn't want him to get the flu shot, we are going to have a very hard time differentiating between COVID-19 or flu. So we have to test your child for both viruses. And then there's going to create a level of anxiety regarding school, quarantine, and care that your child is going to need because we don't know if it's the flu. Now, you can get the flu from after getting the flu vaccine, but you're going to be protected from some of the major complications that we see when you have the national illness, and the duration of the illness is much shorter. Instead of being, 2 weeks with the national illness, it may be 2 to 3 days. So I explained that to the parents. I explained the importance of getting all the children's immunizations on time, and believe it or not, there's a critical, important piece of information I need families to understand. Even though through COVID-19, pediatricians are open, family doctors are seeing children too. The importance of a well child visit to be up to date, and your teenagers and the shots is critical, because we don't want to change a pandemic for a measles epidemic or whooping cough. So we have vaccines to prevent illnesses. So let's use them. Let's get them.
Yeah, and I think there's a really particularly communication point that has to be, right, because particularly for the underprivileged populations, getting vaccinations, that message has to come from people who sound and look like them. It cannot come from the systems, right? And that's where engaging your community outreach folks is going to be so critical to be able to get those. And it may not be having them coming to the hospital. It may be, you know, having, you know, the local pharmacy or having folks who are able to engage them there, because I just, as you point out, Joanna, there's so much mistrust. And particularly folks are just, when you can make the message, put the message through a medium that they're more comfortable with, that's just going to be, that's so critical to address some of the social determinants that inhibit a lot of our underserved populations. I'm sorry, David.
One of the things that happens is they have to step into the public health role in new ways. And that's encouraging because it's going to be needed coming forward. CVS Aetna, for instance, has 1,800 testing sites right now around the United States that they're expanding, and they're in negotiations to become vaccination centers. So just to your point, the neighborhood drugstore being actually now a health hub where you can get vaccinated. We're also working with folks in the Southern Hemisphere right now. It's very interesting. They're in the depths of winter in the Southern Hemisphere. The pandemic is certainly spreading and hitting places very hard, whether it's Melbourne, Australia, Santiago, Chile, Johannesburg, South Africa. But what's interesting is that the incidence of other seasonal viruses is at an all-time low, historic lows, and it's across a wide spectrum. So influenza, RSV, pneumococcus rates, extraordinarily low, suggesting that obviously measures such as social distancing, mask wearing, hand washing are going to be more important than ever, and obviously vaccinating against flu and pneumococcus for older patients is going to be important. And hopefully in North America, as we enter into winter, that we'll get similar effects that will suppress, like we did in the spring, some of the seasonal virus activity.
And I think one important point about this is mask wearing. And so, you know, for example, places like Australia, you just mentioned, and Chile, people are being compliant with using masks. And so this is a message that we really need to also share with our community and the population, that mask, wearing your mask is important, not only for COVID-19, but it does prevent the exposure to other viruses and illnesses. And that, you know, I tell my pediatric patients, wearing your mask is showing your love, is caring. And so, and they do it. They do it very well.
Yeah, the kids are better. The parents.
And David, you talked about not just the mask, but the washing of the hands. I think people are a lot more conscious of it. But there was an article here, and Jason, you may be aware of this, but I was stunned at the number of homes on the Navajo reservation that have to haul water to have water in the Hogan. And if you haul that water, you're not going to be nearly as generous in washing your hands for 20 seconds as I am. I mean, I turn on the faucet and wash my hands. Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm hearing from the three of you, and I love it that you're reinforcing each other, is that as professionals, executives, consultants, executives, pediatricians, executives, leadership consultants, this message has to come from every direction. In Utah, I can't tell you how many people think it's a hoax. It scares me to death. I mean, my financial advisor that I've known since college actually said, you know how many people under the age of 21 have died from COVID? And I said, well, no. And his point was, he wanted to take everything out and it was less than 200. And I said, you know, you're not looking at the facts correctly. This is an executive.
As we near the halfway point of our discussion, I'd like to share a quick overview of the Healthcare Executive Group. We're a national network of executives and industry thought leaders celebrating our 32nd year working together to improve and reshape healthcare. Our mission is guiding healthcare executives through innovation, change, and growth. We interact regularly across multiple channels, including frequent HCG thought leadership webinars and podcasts like this one, national industry pulse research and reports, white papers, social media, newsletters, and other activities in support of healthcare executives. By facilitating these frequent interactions, which are all virtual at the moment, We aim to provide a platform forum for networking, information sharing, and critical issue discussions. You can learn more about how we convene, promote, and support networking and facilitate healthcare executives by going to hceg.org. Also, throughout the year and culminating in at the year end, our members discuss and debate critical priorities in healthcare. We then formally vote and rank what we call an HCG Top 10 list of healthcare leader priorities for the coming year. You can see those priorities over the years on our website, and we will invite you to virtually help us vote and rank the HCG Top 10 for 2021.
In other aspects of society. But one of the things that I'd like to get your insights into are some of the issues we're seeing with long haulers, folks who actually are continuing to demonstrate symptoms, troubling symptoms for many weeks, months, and potentially for some of them, it could be long-term. So we're talking widespread neurologic complications, cardiovascular complications. Obviously, there's aspects of this disease we don't quite fully understand, tell us a little bit about particularly your concerns in, say, younger individuals who may have had minimal symptomatology but have persistent symptoms going forward that don't seem to be resolving.
Yeah, I would agree, Ferris. You know, one of the challenges is, you know, when folks are saying, oh, this is a hoax or this is not real, I think part of it is just recognizing what they're seeing, right? And then what's relevant to them. The challenge is when we have all this uncertainty, right? When we have so many different messages and there are all these aspects about the COVID-19 and its pathology in the body that we have are only beginning, you know, to get a sense that, oh, folks aren't dying from pneumonia. They're dying from microinfarctions throughout their lungs it's the overwhelming immune response that's killing them, not the typical virus reproduction that may be caused. And then the neurologic symptoms and the muscle symptoms, right, where the virus is infecting whole bodies. We have no knowledge of that. So, you know, when folks see things, right, and I think part of that is seeing them where their eyes, it's recognizing, hey, look, you know, there's still a lot of uncertainty about this. What's right for you is going to be right for you, but do you want to do that in a vacuum or do you want to do that with better information? And right, and so how do we help better inform you about what those risks are? Because we know that the data is constantly evolving, and we have, how do we help you be alive for that so that we're working together to figure out, okay, because one person going back to work by themselves is not going to fix the economy, right? It's how do we do this together? And how do we address all the different concerns that people are going to be having for, be it their economic ones, be it their elder parents, be it the long-term consequences for the individual. How do we be alive to the things that are most highest priority for them in terms of what's the information that they need to make a better decision?
So, and that's a good comment if I could break in. You know, we could go, this could go on for hours and days and everything, but what do we want to do here in the next,
I hope you're recording it because we have, you know.
Oh my God, are you kidding me? We got like 9 hours of content here.
Yeah.
I could like blow it up into trying 90. But, you know, Are you guys seeing the screen here?
We're seeing a chart. Word document or a word.
Okay, so just real quick. This is, Ferris and I have been working on the 2021 top 10 list. And we're talking about like the supply chain, you know, rethinking this because, you know,
Steve. That's not what we're seeing. At the top it says word and good afternoon.
Oh shoot. Well,
that's not what we're seeing.
All right. Well, you know what? Anyhow, I can send this to you, but what can we do like for this specific thing that we want to pull off here in the next week or so? You know, we got a lot of content here, and maybe we don't need to do another recording. You know, I don't know. But I think, you know, there's what I'm looking at is supply chain. We got pandemic related prevention and treatment. We've got the whole public health stuff. We've got the revenue recovery, COVID, you know, recapturing all this revenue, the pent up demand for elective services, the volume shift from acute to ambulatory to the home, right? And then the safety thing someone mentioned, you know, the patient safety, the provider, the employee. I mean, my wife, she worked at a high-end recovery rehab center. She won't go back because these people coming back, just they don't care, and she was going to risk us. Plus, that $600 federal thing was sort of nice. But anyhow, the community-based approach, you know, I mean,
we will share this for your input. As all three of you know, at the forum, we had a lunch and we talked through issues, and then we had a voting list that people selected the 2020. That we're not going to have a forum, so we're going to do this in a new way. We don't know exactly what the way is going to be, but we're starting to build the voting list, and the voting list this year is different, and it's different because of COVID. And we're capturing as much of that as we can to put it into it. But I think, David, you're asking all the right questions. And from this discussion, we can distill this down into maybe each of you think about what are the two or three questions that David's asked or didn't ask that you'd like to be asked during the podcast that would generate the type of discussion that's here. And David, you are part of this. You're more than a moderator. And I think the perspectives that SG2 can provide, like, you know, the Southern Hemisphere. I still, in my mind, visualize David talking about value-based reimbursement and contrasting the U.S. to Europe. That perspective, knowing how other countries are dealing with COVID, is the same as how other countries are dealing with society and healthcare and value-based healthcare as opposed to this financially driven fee-for-service system that we have. Your perspectives, David, need to be shared throughout, as you've been doing here tonight.
I would definitely, David, be interested in your perspective on how the shift in sort of the reimbursement payment system, right, is going to affect our ability to be able to be more comprehensive in our coverage of the population.
This is one of the most interesting aspects that for almost all of my clinical career, which is 30 years now, physicians generally viewed the least risky way to get paid was a fee-for-service basis. Yeah. What's really interesting is right now in large physician groups and in single specialty groups and health system employee groups, many specialists are thinking differently. They've been in situations now that seen demand for elective procedures, and they're worried about the future. If you can imagine being a bariatric surgeon with a large mortgage and trying to save money for college educations, the right. World changed. It doesn't look like the world is going to come back that way. And so they're having grown-up discussions now about changing the reimbursement models more to delever that risk by going to employment, to going to safer ways of getting paid, including fixed fees. Mm-hmm. The other interesting difference is that most physicians in December of last year probably couldn't really describe a supply chain and certainly couldn't talk to you about the strategic value of a mm-hmm. supply chain. Well, after they went through the PPE shortages and pharmacy shortages, they're now really interested in working with their healthcare stakeholders and hospital stakeholders on how to optimize supply chain activities. And so there's a lot of work around, you know, nationalizing and onshoring. You know, one of the shortages in supply chain is the fact that countries nationalize these products and they're not coming to North America. And we're having to, mm-hmm. you know, work through that. But that's a big change. So with respect to payment models, we're already seeing employers, remember there's going to be some significant economic issues for companies, and employers who are really not that interested in thinking about value-based care and, you know, that just wanted to make sure their employees were happy with health insurance, now are looking at all kinds of, and these are small and medium-sized employers, anything they can do to eliminate costs now. So they're much more interested in an episode of care bundles and basically looking at structural reimbursement models and delever their risk going forward. So Our projections are that, and obviously state governments have been shielded to some degree from the economic impact by federal subsidies. But if their economies turn down in certain states and the tax base erodes, they're going to have to look at their Medicaid programs in about 18 months totally differently. So there's going to be much more cost reduction in that space. So the folks that are also interesting to me are payers.
I think this is a great opportunity about population health. So let's take a step back and talk about pop health, because this is really important. I think this year has been monumental to start changing the shift from fee for service into the importance of a value-based arrangement of total cost of care. I definitely also want to emphasize the importance of innovation and technology. So I would talk to peers 6 months ago. If somebody was telling me that I was going to do a televisit, I would have left. I was like, I cannot see a pediatric patient by computer or phone. And now is, I love it. And definitely it has pushed innovation into healthcare that it was developing, it was slowly happening, but to go from March to April and to see the dramatic jump into utilization of telemedicine is really important, because it's being used as a tool to connect with families, to engage patients, to continue allowing providers and physicians to continue providing the services that they need. And that is part of value-based care. How can you think outside of the box in order to reach the population that is yours, in order to provide the best outcome for your patients? And so, the traditional model is, one-to-one in the office with the physician, and we're moving away from having healthcare done in the home environment, remote monitoring, telemedicine, community health workers, other alternative sites of care in order to complement what we call traditional medicine.
Yep. Wonderful.
I think there are two different populations of providers, though, that we need to think about. One, Joanna, is the folks who are more the elective stuff, who are not the frontline workers now, in the sense that, Dave, you're talking about the folks who traditionally be maybe doing elective surgeries or other, because some of the subspecialty care, where there is an opportunity to transform the way you're delivering care in a way I think that's going to be more effective because of the opportunity to accept a lot of the modalities that, telehealth, it's been pushed forward. I've been doing telehealth, 20 years ago, I was trying to push telehealth, and I saw it in the radiologists and the mental health and the psychiatrists. They loved it because there's just so much more opportunity available to them when they're not one-on-one in a fixed location anymore. And for those folks, I think there's an opportunity to get back to actually better outcomes, right? To connect with your patients in a way that you hadn't before. It's kind of like Zoom. We do a lot of trainings, and I love the chat feature because there's this ability to interact with folks that that I hadn't thought of before. And when you're open to that, I think that in a lot of ways, that's going to be very healthy for healthcare providers to be able to connect to the patients. I think on the other side, though, is those frontline providers that are still stuck with trying to take care of the folks that are coming through the ER or into their ICUs, where there's still not a lot of good information, right? And the struggle that they're going to go through of trying to do the best that they can with all the uncertainty and the limitations that we have. And I think for those folks, we have to be really mindful that there's a great burden that our traditional thought about what the role of the provider is, right? Or the physician, that I think we have to help see beyond, right? And get into that, what's the best that you can do, right? What's your role? Not the best outcome that you're going to be able to get for, that you wish for every patient, but what's the best that you can do within your circumstances, and being more mindful to the limitations that your role is going to be, that is going to have. I think it's hard because be it the lack of the supply chain, the lack of PPE, the challenges of what tests are available or not available. Until that gets standardized, Dave, right? Until the hospital organization has been able to get some trust in the data that they have, and the testing methods that they have, and the treatments available, supply chain that they have, it's just going to be hard to be a frontline provider.
So what can we do here? Like, we're coming up in an hour, and let's we got so much information, and it's like, I don't want to say all over the board. It's pretty narrow, but
no,
what can we do
good.
Here? No, very good, very good. What can we do here?
Just going back to the very beginning, I got this picture in my mind of a yin yang.
This little thing.
And, this little one. What's changing? What's not going to change? I mean, that's what this is. It's this tug of war between the reality of COVID and the reality of all of the non-COVID stuff in healthcare that has to be dealt with. The hybrid, Ioana, you mentioned school system where, okay, my children are very important, but the other part of that yin yang is, okay, one of the two of us are not going to be able to work. This is a yin yang in my mind. And maybe there's something there. Let Steve and I play around with that. But this tug of war and the change and the lack of change and not changing rapidly enough, all of that is coming together here as I hear you discussing.
We really appreciate the opportunity to have Drs. DiLoretto, Vidal Phelan, and Wu with us today to discuss the challenges and the changes that are taking place with respect to COVID-19. There is much left to be discussed on October 1st in our live interactive chat and Q&A with these three physicians. We anticipate new ideas, questions, and comments will come to your minds as you listen to these perspectives on the podcast and prepare for the October 1st session. Please send us your questions, comments, or requests for additional information via the bit.ly/3physicians. prior to October 1st, or just plan to submit them during the live chat. Our physician panel will enjoy exchanging thoughts and perspectives with all of you on what lies ahead for the fall. Also, we invite you to join us in our ongoing discussions throughout this year via LinkedIn, YouTube, Twitter, and our biweekly newsletter. Finally, a special thanks to our 6 annual HCG technology partners and sponsors, Change Healthcare, Hinge Health, Softion, SureScripts, Zealous, and Zipari. HCG could not exist the way that we do without their support. And of course, thanks to all of you for listening to the podcast and for planning to join us on October 1st for the live chat and Q&A. In the meantime, stay safe, be well, and have a great day.